The first time it happened, my brain said to me, oh, that's some really cool CGI. And then a couple of seconds later, my brain went, wait a minute, this is a play, not a movie. And I had a tiny little existential crisis.
That's the same feeling that I had the first time I got to see the show. And that's one of the beautiful things about this show. It's not like we have these moments where we stop and there's a magic trick. Ta-da, everyone clap for me.
Magicians have a complicated relationship with the Harry Potter franchise. On the one hand, the success of J.K. Rowling's creation has given us hours of work at movie premieres, book launches, and themed events. On the other hand, it's hard having to deal with constant jokes about where our broomsticks are and whether we were raised under a staircase. So, what happens when the world of the magician collides with the world of wizardry? Since 2016, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child has been combining stories from J.K. Rowling's wizarding world with extraordinary stage magic. There's no suspension of disbelief. The characters appear to be performing real magic live on stage. Lee Cohen is the magic and illusions consultant for the Australian production of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. On this episode of the podcast, I sit down with Lee to talk about how she got this incredible job, how she teaches magic to actors who've never picked up a trick in their life, and the differences between theatrical illusions, magic tricks, and special effects. If you enjoy this episode, please leave a review at your favorite podcast dispensary. It's also a great way to ask questions or suggest topics for future episodes and to give my ego the stroke it so desperately needs. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza.
If my children tell their friends that their friend Lee works at Hogwarts.
It's true. I do work at Hogwarts. It's what I like to tell people as well. My official title is Australian Magic and Illusions Associate, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child Australia. So that basically means that I take care of the magic and the illusions in the show, but only in Australia.
And how did you end up, I mean, I know this already, sure. But because, okay, I'm going to try and say this, and you know what I mean, but I want the listeners to understand that I'm not being rude when I say this. But my first reaction when I heard that you had the job, and this is the first reaction of several people, was to go, really? Lee? And then to think about it for 10 seconds and think about all your experience and all the things you've done and who you are and go, of course, Lee. Lee, yes. Of course, this is the perfect person. But how did they figure out that you were the right person?
Adam has previously been working.
This is Adam Marder.
That's right, Adam Marder.
Mutual friend.
Yep, worked on the show when it first opened in Australia and was the associate, Magic and Illusions associate for, I think, about 4 years it ended up being. So he was with the show right through the two-part iteration. So yes. For anyone that doesn't know, it started out being in two parts and it was a 5.5 hour extravaganza to watch both parts. When that was coming to an end to be reimagined as the one part show, Adam was moving on to some other projects. They were looking for someone else to take on the role, and my name was thrown in that mix, I believe, by Adam, and a number of other people as well were interviewed. And that interview process was fairly quick, as interview processes go. It all sort of happened within the course of a week and a half to 2 weeks of me being asked by Adam if I was interested in the role, and then actually being on an interview with the executive creative team in London. Because the show is part of the greater world of Harry Potter, and there are versions of the Cursed Child show in a number of cities around the world, so everything goes through their executive team in London. So I did 2 rounds of interviews, and they asked me all sorts of questions. Only a small portion of those were really about specifics of magic-related things. There was sort of an understanding that I had that background and I knew things about magic, they actually were really interested in the other experience that I have. And I guess that's how they kind of came to the decision that I was the right person for the job, because I sort of have this experience in event management and other things as well.
Which professional magicians as a group often don't have other skills. Like we are, as a group, we're very good at magic and often are terrible at anything else that isn't magic related. And so whenever you meet a magician who can play a musical instrument or knows how to run a small business or anything like that, it's always like, ooh, look at this, a polymath. So like, before we get to your many other skills, what is your, can you tell you're a second generation magician.
Yes.
So you've magic in your blood.
I guess I do, yeah.
Similar to the characters of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, you come from magic family.
I do come from a magic family, although technically if we were in the wizarding world, I'd probably be a mudblood.
Yes.
My dad is a magician, but my mum is not.
Filthy, filthy mudblood.
Exactly. but it, you know, means that I relate to Hermione Granger quite well.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you've got Hermione. I would have said, Hermione, absolutely. Maybe a little bit of Luna in there as well.
Yeah, definitely a Luna Lovegood.
Yeah. And we've talked a lot because you grew up around magic and magicians. And when I first met you, I think it was quite a while before I saw you perform, and I spent a lot of time not knowing you, not sure whether you were a magician or not. And it was something we've talked about before, which is whenever there was a magic event and you'd have these, it's changed a lot now, but it would be, you know, you would be the only woman in the room.
Yes.
And you would be dragged up on stage to be the assistant and to help with the tricks and to have magicians vaguely patronize you and perform tricks that you could probably do better yourself. And I noticed that you were always very obliging and very kind. But I get the sense that there's quite a few people in the magic community may have underestimated you.
I guess I haven't thought about it from that perspective, that people underestimated me. But I suppose in a way that is probably true because I grew up in the industry and so many people knew me as a child.
Oh, yeah.
I was originally just kind of tagging along with my dad and then sort of assisting my dad in his shows. Mm. And then as a teenager, I sort of started doing some of my own shows, but that's not something that anyone in the magic community would have really seen or known about at the time. So from their perspective, I was kind of Les's daughter, just coming along to lectures and shows. And I suppose to them, I was just someone who they could call up on stage and, you know, do their trick. And that worked because often traditional magic tricks, the patter is geared for male magicians to perform to a female spectator. Yes. So that's kind of mostly all they'd ever seen me do. I know you were saying we'll come back to other skills, but none of them had ever seen me, you know, perform as a musician or a singer or any of the other things that I'd been doing. So they just had none of that context, I suppose.
Yeah, because you do have an experience in theatre as well, both on and off stage. So singer, you mentioned.
Yeah, so I did a little bit of singing and just amateur musical theatre when I was in my late teens and early 20s.
What musical theatre did you do? What productions?
I was in The Scarlet Pimpernel.
Really? Yes. Oh, wow. Who were you in that?
Oh, I was ensemble.
I see. Oh, how embarrassing. Moving on. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean
I learned many dances and learned how terrible I am at dancing. No. So I did that and a lot of short films with friends because I grew up with some people who now are in video production, and one of them just started working at Disney and another one has his own video production company. And so we used to do like 24-hour film festivals and all of those types of things as well. So that sort of, I guess, gave me a much broader perspective of both performing and production. And, you know, I would work in wardrobe or do the makeup or make the sets.
You trained in makeup, right?
Well, I technically didn't train. I just kind of started doing it.
No one stopped you.
Pretty much. It really was one of those things that, I mean, back in the day, it was harder to do courses, and short courses didn't exist in the way that they do now. I mean, they were around, but they were very expensive. Mm. And I was a teenager when we were doing, you know, short films and crazy things like that. And so it was just kind of everyone going, well, I like doing cameras and I like doing makeup. And so we would just do these things, and that would lead to another thing, to another thing, to another thing. And eventually I just, for a while, part of my business was actually doing makeup for weddings and TV shows and all of that sort of thing as well.
It also sounds like, look, so when you first told me that you had gotten this job, mm. we were having coffee, and when you were telling me, you were, one of the reasons why you were telling me was because you had just bought a brand new iPad and you had been told by Adam, I believe, like he said, go and buy an iPad, buy a fancy one because you're going to need it. And that was because a huge amount of this job with Harry Potter is administrative. It is like, it is, organizing people and props and who knows what and when and how and so on. And that is something that you also have experience with. Like, you've worked at, we were talking just before we started about the Melbourne International Film Festival. I know you've done a lot of stuff with Adelaide Fringe. So you're an arts admin person.
Yeah. So I have also done a lot of event management, again, since I was a teenager, just because I liked putting on shows or producing my own magic shows as I got older as well. I was the director at the Melbourne Magic Festival, so that required a lot of administration, both just in terms of dealing with other artists, but also marketing and tons of different areas. I did some work in ticketing as well, so learning ticketing systems, like big tessitura type systems.
I don't even know what that means.
So tessitura is one of the biggest ticketing systems in the world, and it gets used at major events, venues. So the Art Centre were using it, the Australian Ballet, ACME, NGV. Mm-hmm. I think it was created at, I may well be corrected on this, but I think it was created at MoNA in New York. Mm-hmm. So it's a worldwide massive system. And that's just one example, but I've done quite a lot of that sort of thing. Front of house management as well was one of the main things that I did at Adelaide Fringe, which that then requires working across both your team of people who are working on the venues, but liaising with the production staff within the venues, but also the ticketing agencies, because you're dealing with patrons who have tickets to come into shows. So there's a lot of interdepartmental work.
Yeah. So it sounds like, I mean, that then makes it very clear why you would be the right person to come in and do this job for The Cursed Child, in that obviously magic background, but also theatre background, and also arts admin. Oh, and also teaching, because you do teach magic. You get a, I know we've talked about a lot of magicians, they, you know, it's kind of in that those who can do, those who can't teach, they're like, oh, I'm not getting enough work, I better start a magic class. Whereas for you, you really love teaching magic, particularly to kids,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So there's a few reasons why I love teaching, but it's also probably worth noting that magic hasn't been the only thing that I've taught over the years. I actually originally was teaching music, because I studied classical music, piano and theory from the time I was about 4 years old, I think, until well after I finished school. And so I used to teach piano and theory. Discovered that I really enjoyed that process, and also was kind of coming to terms with the fact that there weren't many women in the industry, and that learning certain things for me was challenging, because I had to learn techniques, learn effects, but then also reconstruct them, because they didn't necessarily work in their existing form for me, or just a female performer in general.
Yeah.
For many reasons that can
pockets come. Is the
pockets
big one.
Is a big thing. Yeah. Well, and it's also that they don't have the right type of pockets.
Yeah.
I have a little bit of fashion in my background from when I was a teenager as well. I did textiles at school and was really interested in costume making.
Mm.
And if, you know, anyone who's sort of delved into that side of things, women's pockets are constructed differently and placed differently to how they are on men's trousers, for instance, or even jackets.
Yeah.
And so what you can fit in there without looking like you've got, I don't know, you know, 20 decks of cards in your pockets.
Yes. Yeah.
is quite different.
Yeah.
And so for me, that all kind of led to having an interest in teaching other people, because it was really something that I didn't quite know how to learn these things when I was a kid. And so it was much later when I really started applying those things.
Mm.
I think the lucky thing for me was that because I had tagged along with Dad for all those years, I'd absorbed a whole lot of knowledge and methodology from being at these magic lectures and explanations of how things worked before I really sort of, you know, had that spark of thinking, oh, maybe I could do this myself.
Yeah.
And so when I came to that point, then I already had all this knowledge that I could put into practice and start applying to what I was trying to do.
Yeah, and it's something I've noticed about really great magicians, and I think the kind of magicians who perhaps teach or write for other magicians, you know, which if listeners don't know is a huge part of the industry, as magicians will produce things for other magicians. But the magicians I think who are the best at that are not necessarily those with a lot of knowledge or skill in performing, but the sort of an understanding of magic, of knowing how it works and why it works and how to adjust it and change it and how to make it their own or make it someone else's, and that kind of, there is a big difference between being able to do something in magic and actually understanding it.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one thing that people outside of the magic industry probably don't realize is that there are a lot of effects that are available to us in what we call a commercial sense.
Yeah.
And that means you buy the routine. You buy the prop, you buy the routine, and it tells you what to say and what to do when.
Yeah.
And for some magicians, that's all they're looking to do, and that's fine. There's a place for that in the industry.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
But then the next level on that is magicians who will tweak that and turn it into their own routine. Mm. But that is a skill of its own.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that's where, I mean, stepping into this role, Cursed Child, that's when all of that comes into play. So you arrive, they say, yes, you're hired, and you step into this job where the cast are a mix of people who haven't performed the show in a couple of years and people who are brand new to the show, and you don't know any of the magic effects yet, and you now need to step in, learn the effects, and teach people and also retrain people just straight out of the gate. Yeah. How do you do that?
By learning a lot in a very short time frame. So we essentially, what happened was the two-part show closed, and then a couple of days later we started the rehearsal process for the one-part show. There were some cast members staying and some new cast members coming on board. So what you said is right. We had a mixture of people who had done the show before and then some who were brand new to the Wizarding world, which for me was actually kind of lovely because I was new to the show as well, and so we were all learning that process together. To learn the show, I was very, very lucky that we had the creative team or members of the creative team come across from the UK. And one of those people was Chris Fisher, and he's the International Magic and Illusions Associate. So he essentially takes care of everyone in my role on all of the shows. And travels around to the different shows and helps with those processes of teaching new cast and teaching people who are stepping into the role that I'm in now.
Yeah. He's a really nice guy.
He is the loveliest.
I met him you know, sometimes you do a show and someone brings their friend along, and Adam said, oh, this is Chris, and he was so friendly, and I was like, oh yeah, this guy's just a regular friend. And it's like, you know, and he complimented all the performers in the show, and then it turns out he's this, you know, extraordinarily high pressure position.
He's so knowledgeable and so kind and generous, and he's an excellent teacher himself as well. And that was really, I guess, both in some ways, I was a little bit intimidated going in. I didn't want to admit that at the time, but it was a show that came with such a level of, to me, it felt like responsibility to maintain what Adam and Chris had created there and been able to maintain for those last 4 years. But also, people are so familiar with Harry Potter and love Harry Potter and the Wizarding World so much that it felt very high stakes. And it is.
Yeah.
But what Chris was able to do was break everything down in a way which, of course, he's got years of experience working on this
yeah,
show.
Yeah, that's right.
And breaking
yeah.
things down and teaching people going into the role that I'm in. That it made it such a, it was a whirlwind, it was a lot of information to learn, but throughout the rehearsal process of teaching the new cast and the existing cast the new show, he was also teaching me what I needed to know. Mm-hmm. So it was, I suppose for him, it was sort of a little bit of a dual process, but it's a process that he'd done a number of times before, so he knew what I needed to know, and he is so easy to ask questions of, and being able to spend essentially a couple of months while we had that initial rehearsal process just absorbing that information. And this is where the iPad came in very useful, because it became a central place that I could keep, you know, scripts and notes and additional documents that I might need. And, of course, all my emails were there because we're constantly just having discussions between the whole production team of this is what we're doing tomorrow and now this is changing and now we're going to do this next week. And so you just having that central place where you've got all your information but you're also putting your notes was so helpful.
Because there is a lot of magic in the show.
Yes.
And a lot of, for me, I struggle with prop management is like my number one problem as a performer, which is, you know, I have a box of tricks and I have to be able to reach in and the trick needs to be there, the thing I need. And often there's one tiny thing that, you know, an elastic band, a, you know, thing, and it's not there.
Yes.
And I am, one of my great strengths as a performer is the ability to roll with it, you know, to be adaptable and to change when things go wrong. Because I am so bad, like I can, you know, I spend so much time on it and still will forget props. You don't have that luxury.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's probably something where the experience that I had managing shows, because I've managed like some large scale concerts that had fairly high level production things, you know, aerials and indoor fireworks and loads of animals and camels and all sorts of crazy things. The processes that I had learnt and developed over the years doing those types of things served me well coming in, because I had an idea of the level of, I guess, admin, I suppose you would call it, but just that level of documentation that I needed to be aware of and maintain. But also I had an idea of what the other departments were going to be working with coming in. It wasn't a new structure for me.
Yeah, okay.
Certainly in this context, it was yes. new, and working on a show that is as big as this is new. But I mean, I'd worked with props departments and stage management departments and lighting and special effects and all of those structures previously.
Yeah.
Whereas if you came into it not having that understanding of how those teams interact, I could see that could be quite challenging to also be learning that as well as all of the magic, because there's basically, it's the same show in terms of the magic from the two part to the one part. It's all still there.
Yeah.
There's very little that that didn't make it across to the one-part show, and then there's other things that have been added. So in terms of Yeah.
What was added?
You'll have to compare them.
I haven't seen them, but can you tell me in a coded way that will...
Let's see what was added. There's a lot of things that were enhanced with additional special effects.
Like what? Come on, like just like what is something? Give me an example.
I don't know what I'm allowed to say and what I'm not, because it's all also merged in my head, the two part and the one part. Because there's still scenes that I go, oh, hang on, did we see that tonight? Oh no, that's not in it anymore.
Yeah, okay.
Because I did see the two parter about six times. Last month. Yeah, yeah.
Where did you see the two parter?
Well, so when it was still open in Melbourne, I found out that I had the job prior to it closing.
Got it. Okay.
So I got to see the show quite a number of times.
Yes.
There's more fire.
Yes.
There's much more fire.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the fire, because there is literal fireballs being shot from wands at actors' faces. And as a professional magician, it is my opinion that the way in which that trick is done is by one performer shooting a fireball right next to the other performer's face. Like, I don't think that's a magic trick. I think one of those, that's actually happening, right? There really is fireballs being shot at each other on stage.
There really is fire being shot across the stage, yes. But I'll put the caveat on that everything we do is highly rehearsed.
Oh, yeah.
And safety the absolute utmost for everything that we do. And the magic of theatre, I guess, in general, but also a show that is as big as this, is that we're able to do things in a way that you walk away feeling like someone just shot a fireball.
Mm. One of the things that you told me about the show, and again, we can take this out if it's not... that's too secretive, is that the person who has the highest amount of risk to deal with, the person who's got the fire nearest them, is actually the person who gives the cue that the fire should now be shot in their direction.
Okay. So there's a whole series of different ways that things get cued. So this is actually not only with Harry Potter, this is theatre in general. So stage managers have like a big cue book which involves all sorts of things from scripting cues to lighting cues to physical like actions that might be a cue. And this is why a rehearsal process on big theatre shows is as long and intensive as it is, because for each thing that happens, everyone involved in that scene is aware of what the cues are. And that as soon as I move my arm, someone is going to change the lighting or, you know, whatever it happens to be. And so it's sort of everything that you see in a theatre show is this highly choreographed piece.
Yeah.
And that is also what contributes to the safety. So we rehearse everything a lot to make sure that everyone is really across all of those things as they need to be in various sequences.
Yeah. And you've said to me that in learning the secrets, that one of the biggest sort of secrets, for want of a better word, of this show and why the magic is so extraordinary and so dazzling is that the audience is incapable of imagining how much time and effort and energy and rehearsal and money the people involved have put into the thing that is appearing on stage.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's true for any magic, for any magician who delivers an effect really well.
Mm.
And the very nature of magic is that it looks like you're not doing anything to make this thing happen, but you've actually put in probably hundreds, if not more, of yes. hours to rehearse it so that the actions you're doing are completely invisible to the audience.
Yeah.
And so that's what is inconceivable to an audience, because, you know, why would anyone spend hundreds of hours practicing how to fan cards, or, you know, not yeah. that there's card fans in Harry Potter, but just as a general magic example. Like, these are things that to a non-magician... It just seems crazy.
Yeah.
And it kind of is.
Yeah.
But also, I think the motivation for spending those hours is that we get to give that sense of joy and mystery, and give audiences those moments of disbelief of how on earth did I see that just happen front of me.
And this show is – so when I go into a magic show, I am impressed mm-hmm. and I am fooled.
Mm-hmm.
But I am rarely amazed.
Right.
I rarely have like an emotional gasp of like, and feel as if, hold on, I don't understand what's happening. Like the something is wrong with reality feeling that you can get from really great magic.
Yep.
And this show gave me that feeling from just like, wait, hang on, what? Like, there's a I can say time turner. Like, yeah. there's time turners in the show, and so there is a time travel happens yes. in the show. And if every time they travel in time, there is a something visual happens.
Mm-hmm.
And when my brain said to me, "Oh, that's some really cool CGI," and then a couple of seconds later, my brain went, "Wait a minute, this is a play, not a movie." And I had a tiny little existential crisis from that moment of just seeing reality warp in front of me.
Yes, and that's the same feeling that I had the first time I got to see the show. I saw it the first time about halfway through the lockdowns in one of the short stints that we were able to get out, and the show was open. And there were several moments in the show where I just was, you know, blown away by the scale of something and the feeling that gives you. But it's, you know, with the time turning particularly, we're talking about, you know, integrating so many different elements to make an effect happen. And that's one of the beautiful things about this show, is that everything's so interwoven between the different art forms that are being used to deliver the magic, but it's also completely interwoven with the narrative of what's happening on stage. It's not like we have these moments where we stop and there's a magic trick. Ta-da, everyone clap for me.
Yeah.
It's part of the story. You still have, you know, the time and the space to see and feel what's happened, but you're not stopping and going, "Oh yay, magician, well done."
Yeah. And that's something like magic, because magic traditionally, people always think of magic as being outside of it's outside of reality, it's fantastical, and it is, but it can only do that by having one foot firmly in reality.
Yes.
You know, it's like if the deck of cards is suddenly back in new deck order from, you know, Ace to King and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's only impressive if you're very certain that deck has been shuffled.
Yes.
You've got to have that real sense of reality and you've got to have that space and so on. But in a play, you don't stop to sort of say, this is what reality is.
Yes.
And now look, we're breaking the rules of reality.
Yeah, and I think that's the luxury that we have when we're doing a theatre show and a play. It's that people have kind of already made that unwritten contract and decision and agreement when they purchase their ticket, that they're coming in and they're putting aside reality and they're seeing a story play out.
Mm.
And so they've already unconsciously decided that they're willing to buy into that.
Yeah.
And so we don't have that limitation of having to convince everyone that this deck of cards has been shuffled or, you know, we still, as magicians, we know that there are things that we do without drawing attention to it to, you know, like to prove that something is a legitimate object or
the hat
whatever.
Is definitely empty.
Yeah, and so all of those principles are still employed throughout the show and the delivery of the effects, but it's not, as you say, it's not those moments that are grounded in reality that we have when we're presenting magic in a more traditional sense.
Yeah, because you could, I guess, view all of the magic that happens in the show as special effects.
Yeah.
You know, that someone could come and watch the show and not think about them as tricks and not think about them as impossible things happening right in front of their eyes, but just see them as special effects in the same way as, you know, oh, I don't know how Iron Man flies around, but I know it's a special effect of some sort, and you know, and you can still enjoy the show.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that it's one of those really interesting things is that when you start working in illusions in a theatre context, that there becomes a lot of blurred lines between what's an illusion, what is lighting design, what is a special effect, what and there's no right or wrong answer to where any of those things fit in.
Yeah.
And you very quickly understand that everything contributes to delivering the magic.
Yeah.
And that's also where the interdepartmental workings come into play, is that no one can do it without the team.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very different thing for magicians as well, is that we're so used to sort of having this level of secrecy and keeping as much as we can out of necessity to ourselves, but not necessarily working in that team context in a way.
Yeah.
But what's really lovely for me at Harry Potter is that everyone's, you know, signed their NDAs and committed to keeping the secrets of the show, and I don't have to be so concerned about what I'm saying about the magic when I'm in the building, because everyone's on board with keeping those secrets.
Yeah, I've found non-magicians who are learning magic for a specific purpose, be actors, or I was talking to a drag queen the other day, you know, about they're doing magic and they want the magic to be better.
Yeah.
And I find that in general, they're more respectful of the secrets and more respectful of the art form often than magicians, who can sometimes be a little slack about that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I've found the actors are very respectful of it, and a lot of times it's because they don't have a lot of knowledge of what it means to be a magician or all of the theory and psychology behind it, so they're not really sure what they can and can't say. And particularly for me, what I've experienced is that I'm being brought in as an expert. They have a level of respect that I know about this and they don't, and so they treat that information with respect. And then I think the other thing that has been really set up really well by Chris Fisher, by Adam, and by Jamie, who's the illusion designer on the show, is that they've created an atmosphere where we're bringing the team, the actors, the crew into the idea of what it means to deliver magic. If we do a session with the cast when they first start, that's an introduction to magic, and they learn a couple of basic effects, or what we as magicians would call basic effects.
Yeah.
And we sort of have a chat about what those principles are and why we keep those things a secret and don't share them.
Yeah.
The other lovely thing that I discovered coming into Harry Potter and the Cursed Child was that right from the beginning, they had told the cast, if there's an illusion that you're not involved in a scene and you don't want to ruin the magic for yourselves, don't be in the room when we rehearse that. Like, if you don't have to be in the room, then you don't have to know how it's done.
Yeah.
And there are people on the show who have been there for 4 years since it started, who there are illusions that they still don't know how they work because they've chosen that they want to maintain some of that mystery for themselves.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that they have theories and probably, you know, if they thought about
some
it.
Some rough idea. Yeah.
They are, you know, they're performers and they enjoy just the general magic of theatre, let alone the magic of the effects that we do as magicians. And so they've wanted to maintain that. And I think when you come across artists and performers who really kind of get that what we're doing is telling a story and sharing emotions and feelings with the audience, they kind of have almost a better understanding of why we're not sharing how it works, because they've done that training. That's what they spend their life doing, is sharing emotions and taking audiences on a journey.
Yeah.
And that differs from magicians in that most magicians, not all, but most magicians don't actually have any training in performance.
Yeah.
In acting, in, you know, portraying emotions. Some will come to that later and seek training in those areas down the track once they kind of are already established as magicians. But on the whole, there are very few magicians who have actually done dramatic training.
Mm. And those who have, or like, you know, actors who have learnt magic often give really great performances. Like, you watch someone like Neil Patrick Harris perform magic. And even if, as a magician, you go, oh, that's a simple trick, or that's not that amazing. But he has the ability to bring you into a story, the story of the trick. So it's amazing. Chris Pratt. Mm. You know, Chris Pratt,
yes.
He performs a card trick. It's one that every magician has seen performed a million times, where it looks like you failed to find the card, and then at the end you find the card.
Yep.
And he does the trick, and he's doing it on the show, and the trick just goes on just a little bit too long. Mm-hmm. He just gets a tiny, tiny bit flustered, and the guests around him are awkwardly shifting in their seats and laughing nervously at this terrible card trick, and then boom, he finds the thing at the end, and it's utterly amazing. Not because of the method,
yep.
but because of that, what you're talking about, the ability to sort of tell the story of the trick.
Yes, and I've seen the routine that you're talking
about.
Isn't
it great?
It's fantastic.
So yeah.
And it's exactly what you're saying. I mean, it's the ability to take people on that journey is something that I've always had an interest in.
Yeah.
And in fact, I would still not put myself in a category of saying I'm, you know, technically an amazing magician, or, you know, like I don't feel like I have a whole lot of really technical skills, like, you know, your Simon Coronels of the world, and those really kind of difficult to do moves. I mean, you know, maybe I do some. I'd have to have a think about it. but what I have always really enjoyed and focused on is taking people on a journey and telling a story. And that is something where I feel like I have had a high level of skill, and I think both are just as important.
Like,
whether it's technical skill or storytelling, they're both really, you know, important skills, and drawing on both of those is what sort of then leads to, you know, a really beautiful performance.
Oh, that's very nicely said.
Oh.
Okay, so now this is my most important question, and that I want to know your opinion. This is an opinion one, because some people haven't seen the show. I'm gonna say this codedly as possible.
Sure.
There are two characters
mm-hmm.
who are very close.
Yes.
Are they gay? In your opinion?
Oh, in my opinion, they are. They're teenagers, and they are discovering whether they are or not.
Oh, what an amazing cop out.
No, well, but that is the journey. So the show is the tale of a father and son, but also the tale of, you know, two friends and their, I guess, progress and growing up through the years of school and discovering who they are.
Yeah.
And it's quite beautiful, but it's also there's a lot more clarity to that story in the one-part show than there was in the two-part. I think in the two-part show it was a little bit ambiguous as to, you know, where their interests kind of fell in terms of...
Their interests fell.
Well, I don't know how else to word it.
Yes.
That's a terrible way of saying
it. Their interests, yeah. Like it's a business proposition. Yeah.
I don't want to give away too much of
we're trying to be coded about. Well, there's two characters... And at the beginning, oh, they're friends. And then their relationships becomes closer and closer and closer.
Yeah.
But it's a bit like Zeno's, you know, Zeno's paradox of the arrow, you know, where the arrow will never quite meet the tortoise.
Yes.
I felt it was like that, but with a gay kiss, where it was like, well, they couldn't possibly, okay, these guys cannot get more clearly gay with, you know, without them just kissing. Yeah, and they just get closer and closer and closer, and then we'll never quite get, I think, like a resolution. And some people are quite angry about that they wanted them.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about the one-part show is that, as I was saying, there is more clarity to that story or that part of the storyline now.
Yeah.
But there's purposely no finality or, you know, resolution as such in the way that you're describing,
mm.
because they're teenagers who are discovering themselves.
So your job now, because you've taught them, the cast knows what they're doing, and so you're not there every single show.
Yep.
What's my job? What's your job now?
Yeah, so I periodically go in and watch the show, and with the purpose of just kind of assessing where the illusions in the show are at and if they're still being performed in the way that they were taught, similar to how either a choreographer, a movement director or a director would be looking at the movement or the scripting, just to make sure that it hasn't drifted,
mm-hmm.
because that can happen over time. And as magicians, we know that happens over time as well, you know, you pick up an effect and you suddenly like, well, hang on, why didn't that work the way it normally does? And if you filmed yourself, you work back through it and you're like, oh, look what I did there.
Yeah.
I held my hand in a different position. Or you know, you might discover that there's some little thing within a prop that's a millimeter off and it's throwing how it actually works. So I'm looking for those sorts of things, so that we can maintain the standard of the show.
Yeah.
So that, you know, people who see it now will get the same level of show and magic effects that the people in 6 months will get, that the people in a year will get, that the people 2 years ago got. That's kind of what the job is. And then, you know, if we have new cast members or anything like that, or someone's learning a new part of the show that they perhaps haven't done before,
mm-hmm.
I'll be working with them as well.
Because the swings, is that the word I'm thinking of?
Yes,
the swings,
covers.
The swings, yep. And covers and understudies and those kind of people, they will, I guess, often have to practice and know a routine that they're never performing on stage or rarely performing on stage. So you have to, I guess, keep those people trained and ready to go, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So like with any show, there are people who... I guess the word people are most familiar with is understudy. And so you sort of understudy these roles, and you might know three or four different roles in the show, but you might only go on once in a while if that person's sick. So, yeah, there is an element of just kind of maintaining those skills for various members of the cast. But even if they are going on, there's also maintenance in that as well. Things wear out over time, so you swap in new versions of things and it feels different because it's newer, or or something might have, you know, slightly been improved design wise so there's always things to kind of look at and maintain.
Well, thank you very much, Lee Cohen. What is your job title again?
Australian Magic and Illusions Associate for Harry Potter and the Cursed Child.
Oh, extraordinary job title, and an extraordinary job. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. It's been fun.